Welcome to Better Sex, where you get the information and inspiration to create and enjoy your best possible sex life. Join your host, sex therapist Jessa Zimmerman, as she brings you expert guests, helpful tips, knowledge, and strategies to improve your intimate relationships. And now, your host, Jessa Zimmerman.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jessa, and I'm so happy you're here for this episode of Better Sex. I've dedicated my professional life to helping couples enjoy a fulfilling intimate life. I believe that sex is important. Our connections to other people matter, and we're not living our life to the fullest if we aren't connecting emotionally and sexually with our partner. That's why I'm here, bringing ideas and information to help you live and love better.
Well, as I sit down to record this, it is December 2nd, 2017, and there is so much sexual scandal in the news right now. It's kind of unbelievable, actually. Started with the hashtag MeToo. And we have now got, I mean, I can't even list them all, but Harvey Weinstein, we've got Al Franken, we've got Louis C.K., we've got Roy Moore, we've even got the President of the United States and other members of Congress being accused of assault, harassment, or inappropriate sexual behavior. And, you know, the Me Too phenomenon has brought this to our awareness in a whole new way, at least as far as I'm concerned. And some of the allegations are about clear violations of consent. Others are more gray. Oh, I didn't realize anyone felt uncomfortable. Or I didn't realize the power dynamic meant they couldn't really consent. I mean, we're hearing people sometimes apologize and sometimes justify and sometimes just deny their behavior. But clearly, something's going on with consent or lack of it. And I hear stories from clients, too. Someone does something to their partner thinking they're going to like it and it goes wrong. Or I hear from people that have been going along with something for a while, even though they don't like it, and they end up feeling resentful, and they're just now speaking up about it. All of this stuff is about consent. All of this has me thinking about how vital consent is, how important it is that people seek it, and that too many people don't understand why they need to keep it in mind, even with a long-term partner. So this brings me to my guest today, Sar Cermak. He's a marriage and family therapist specializing in identity work and couples therapy. But he's also the founder and director of the Consent Academy. Sar teaches as a sex-positive educator, focusing on communication, identity, and consent.
Well, thank you, Sar, for being here with me today. I really appreciate it.
No, my pleasure.
So you are here as a guest to talk about consent. And I'm curious why you think it's important that we're talking about consent for people that are in a committed relationship.
I think the basics is to start off with, you know, consent is important pretty much everywhere. But in a committed relationship, you know, there's all sorts of things that we do with the people we love, with the people we spend our lives with, you know, where we can make mistakes. And sometimes in committed relationships, people forget easily that, you know, they need to ask for consent or get consent for things. Just because they've done so many things for so long, it seems like, oh, we've done that 100 times. It'll be fine. And so people, I think, just sort of forget that they need to pay attention in the same way that they do when they first meet somebody.
Interesting. So do you imagine or advise that people are asking for consent about every single thing they're doing?
Yes, but not in sort of the explicit way that we talk about it. Like, if you meet somebody for the first time, you know, you don't know anything about them. So asking for explicit or enthusiastic consent every single time you want to do something new makes a whole lot of sense.
Right.
When you're with somebody for weeks, months, years, decades, people build what we call a consent framework. Like, they have a base understanding of what the other person will or won't consent to. And generally they just move from that space. They're like, oh, like, I know my partner likes vanilla ice cream. I will bring them vanilla ice cream as a treat. I don't have to ask them specifically, is it okay if I do this sort of thing? But at the same time, if we then neglect that the other person gets to say no, right? If they get to withdraw their consent, even if they've done it 100 times, that's where people get into trouble, because then, you know, the person who brings the ice cream feels rejected because the person didn't want it. Mm. But the person who didn't want it has every right to not want it. And that's just a simple thing. If we talk about things like sex or sexual activity, you fall into this sort of pattern of expectation. And it's the expectation where, oh, obviously we're going to do this thing because we do it every Tuesday night. No, people still get to consent or not.
Right. So there can be a certain sense of entitlement almost.
Yeah.
You know, I get this every Tuesday.
Great. You know, Tuesday is oral sex night. We'll do that every Tuesday.
Right.
But once that expectation gets in place, then one person feels like it's supposed to happen and gets upset when it doesn't. And the other person starts feeling like they have to do that. And then that just sets up a whole point of resentment.
Right, right. So what do you recommend in terms of people addressing, would you say, taking back consent?
Yeah, withdrawing.
About the consent. Yeah, withdrawing consent, checking in on the consent framework. Like, how do you work with people to implement some of that?
A lot of it's just basic communication. Going to a partner and saying, hey, you know, I know we do this thing. You know, we always go out for Thai food every Thursday night. Do you still want to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Or I want to do something different. Start with the easy one, right? Which is anytime you change something, ask for consent for that thing.
Right. Right.
And that gets into the habit. Right? It's an easy way to practice. But the other one is that to recognize that consent exists, that it's not a given. And so being able to turn to your partner and go, hey, do you still want to do this? You know, is this still something you like? Is this still something you're into? Sort of reaffirm the consent as a way of building the relationship,
mm-hmm.
and as a way of building connection and trust within the relationship.
It sounds like part of what you're talking about is the idea that remembering that consent is a temporary license. I mean, it's not something you agree to for the rest of your life.
Right.
And so if the couple is constantly thinking that this is temporary, it needs to be renewed, it needs to be reviewed, don't take anything for granted.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I don't get to assume consent. It is a constant and continuous process that is only valid in the moment when it is given.
Yeah. And it's a nice reminder. You were talking about somebody checking in to make sure their partner still wants to do this thing or still likes it. It seems equally important, of course, that the other partner, the person that might withdraw consent, takes responsibility to do that. Right, to speak up, to know that they're entitled to change their mind or want something different, but to make sure that they speak up.
Yeah, and it's hard. I talk about this a lot when I'm teaching base consent 101 classes. It's hard to say no.
Right.
It's hard to go to somebody, either someone we want to be with or somebody we care about, and say, I'm sorry, I don't want to do that thing. I think about it even just in terms of, you know, hey, we've been together for 10 years and I really want to spend a week off by myself in a cabin. That's not a rejection of the person you're with. That's right. A statement of, here's a thing that would be good for me.
You know, it's so interesting because I've been writing and talking to people lately about how almost sacred a no is. Mm-hmm. You know, like I understand that a lot of people struggle with it. It can be hard to do. But if you can't trust your partner to say no, then you're not really free to want what you want and ask for it. You know, so people hold themselves back because they don't want to make their partner uncomfortable.
Sure. One of the things that we often say is, if I can't trust your no, I can't trust your yes.
Yes, right.
So I want the people I'm with to want to be with me. I want them to be enthusiastic in what it is they're doing, or at least committed intentionally
right,
to what
right.
they're And that yes is just as important. And so when someone says to me, no, I don't want to do that, now I know they're being honest with me, and can then, you know, when they say, yes, I want to do that, I still know they're being honest with me.
Right, right. So you've used a few examples, but I'm wondering if you have any other stories that come to mind that people you've worked with, or, you know, maybe sounds like you're teaching classes about this, things that come up as examples, you know, maybe especially about sex and how couples either get into trouble with consent or handle it well.
Sure. The most common example that comes up in longer term couples is what we were talking about before, right? That base expectation problem.
Yeah. Oral Sex Tuesday.
Oral Sex Tuesday.
Right.
We should make that a thing.
I was going to say, plenty of people listening would probably love to have Oral Sex Tuesday, but...
Yeah, but it's that expectation of, we've done this thing multiple times, we're just going to continue doing it regardless. And the silencing that comes along with that expectation really gets people in trouble, because then either they think they don't have to talk about it, or they think they can't talk about it. And so it builds resentment until it blows up in a big fight or an argument. When stopping along the way and being like, okay, how do I get consent? How do I check in each time? Even just in simple little ways.
So is that how you think people usually find out that they've had a consent problem? Is resentment builds and they end up in a fight? Or is there another way that people realize we should have been checking in on this before?
I think three things pop up. One is we have a fight about something totally unrelated, but it builds back around to the you always or you never or some other statement of that sort. I'm like, oh, wait, here's the thing I'm really upset about. So that's one.
Okay.
Two is they're interacting with somebody else and they have consent affirmed. And they go, oh, this is what that feels like.
Ah, uh-huh. Okay. Like,
oh, great. This is missing. And that sense of, oh, wait, this is something I want with my partner. You know, and here it can be, you know, another lover, or it could be just a friend or even a coworker.
Yeah, I can imagine that even happening at work, that you almost come in contact with I want to use the term consent expert, although that probably doesn't exist, but, you know, have a really good experience with somebody and the contrast would stand out.
Yeah. And the third is sort of the obvious violation. It happens in couples from time to time, right? They're having sex and one of them says stop and the other one doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so sort of the really easily noticeable just pops out as an exception of, wow, my consent has really been violated in this moment, and now I feel terrible.
Yeah.
And then it sort of spawns the, and here's all the ways that I wasn't having my consent affirmed before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So those are, I think, of the three ways where it popped up.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm thinking about couples that I see in practice that have some of those consent issues come up, and it seems like over the years, they tend to almost co-create something.
Mm-hmm.
where somebody violates that line and the other person realizes, you know, I've been going along with things for too long and not speaking up, but this time I'm finally going to sort of raise my hand.
Yeah.
People can get pretty entangled in this stuff for, you know, years sometimes before they're really addressing it.
Well, I think a lot of that has to do, I mean, there's a lot of base cultural expectations for how people are supposed to act either in a marriage or in a long-term relationship. And those base cultural expectations really get people in trouble.
Right.
They sort of step into this place of, well, you know, okay, we're married now, or we've been together for 6 months or a year or whatever. And they're like, oh, well, that means, you know, I give sex whenever my partner asks for it.
Right, right.
Whether I want to or not. And at that point, there is, consent is no longer being given, but it's also not being asked for.
Right, right. Yeah, and it surprises me how long people can go on that way before
decades.
It rises. Yeah, decades before they can maybe realize this is a problem and we've got to do something about it.
Yeah. You mentioned before, like it's popping up now in the media.
Yeah.
And people talking about Harvey Weinstein and Al Franken and all the other popular public figures that people are now speaking out against.
Right.
And I think this is actually a time when people are starting to pay more attention. Like, well, this person spoke up about it. Why haven't I spoken up about it?
Yes. Yes. There's a whole new permission and awareness happening, it seems like, culturally right now.
Which I think is awesome.
I do too. I do.
And is great. And I think it does cause some difficulty in relationships when that's the thing that hasn't been happening in the past.
Yeah. And hopefully people will take all that public awareness and, you know, everything that's in the news now and think, how can I apply this in my own relationship?
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't have to have been a major violation like some of these public figures have had, but, you know, let's be talking about consent in general.
One of the things we talk about in the Consent Academy is consent as a daily practice.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea that, you know, hey, would you like a glass of water? No, thanks, I'm good, is just a simple base practice of offering something. You say yes or no, and I affirm your yes or no.
Right. You don't bring the glass of water anyway. Like, oh, you're going to be thirsty later. Or,
right.
Or no, you're really thirsty. So,
yeah.
I've had a question. I guess it came up in a session once. I heard it somewhere. The difference between a consent violation and a consent accident. And I don't know if that's language you use or if it's a concept that you find useful, but I was curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's a pretty significant debate, actually, amongst educators who are teaching consent right now. Some people really like to use consent accident to define an unintentional mistake.
Mm-hmm.
I misheard you, I misunderstood, we had a miscommunication. I violated consent, but I didn't mean to.
Okay.
While other people argue that it doesn't matter, a consent violation is a consent violation regardless of the intent. So it's really a debate on whose perspective. A consent violation is from the perspective of the person whose consent was violated. They get to choose whether or not their consent was violated and what to call it.
Okay.
A consent accident looks more from the perspective of the person who violated the consent. Did they mean to? What was their intent? Did they not? Now, I think both are important. We tend to use the language we've actually moved to in the Consent Academy is a consent incident.
Okay.
Something has happened. Both sides might have different opinions, perspectives, ideas, concepts, views of what that thing was. But something has definitely happened. And then you need to talk to both sides and see what their concepts, perspectives, ideas are in order to figure out how you can best help.
Yeah, and what do you do with the difference of intention? You know, where one person really didn't hear somebody versus, I mean, at the far end of the spectrum, right, is something like rape or assault. You know, there's a lot of room in between those two. Could you speak to a little bit the range of intention and how you work with people around that to repair it or to discuss it or, you know, what do people do?
They do all sorts of different things with it.
Yeah, or maybe what do you advise that they do?
The first part is to validate. Right. The person whose consent was broken or violated, right, they're having a direct emotional reaction to something that happened to them. However they feel is how they feel.
Oh, right.
Right. So we validate that experience. You know, they have every right to be angry. They have every right to be scared. They have every right to feel however it is they're feeling. The same is true on the other side. The person who violated that person's consent has feelings, thoughts, emotions. And so we do our best to validate those within the context of the other person's perspective is not invalidated by those feelings.
Yeah, they can be true at the same time.
Right. And so being able to talk to the person who's like, well, I didn't mean to do it. right? I didn't intend to hurt this other person. I didn't intend to violate this other person's consent. Being able to talk them through the, that's great, that's okay, and that intent doesn't change the experience for the other person.
Right. You got to spend some time and energy with that person.
Right. And so we have to deal with how that other person's experience has happened, regardless of what the intent was. I use the example all the time. I grew up in Northern Ohio. It was icy. It was very common in the winter. Like, you're driving along, you stop, somebody behind you hits the brakes, their car slides on the ice, and they rear end you.
Right. Right.
Right. And damage your car. Now, they didn't mean to do it. They had no intent to do it. It was a complete misunderstanding of space and friction and all that.
Right.
But they're still responsible for the damage their vehicle caused.
Yes. Yes.
And so being able to make those distinctions is really hard, because it's very common for people to get defensive when they've been accused of violating someone's consent.
What do you think? I mean, I'm just having this question as you share that example. It's probably easier when you rear-end someone's car by accident to make space for the person that got rear-ended.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But somehow sexually, it seems to me that when people violate consent accidentally, that there is more defensiveness. That's a more loaded situation.
Yeah. I think a big piece of it is that we are not taught to think of this in shades of gray. Either someone is raped or they're not.
Yeah.
Either someone is sexually assaulted or they're not. And that legal concept of this situation creates I have to be defensive or I could go to jail.
Yeah, or be really cast in a bad light.
Yeah.
Like I'm a perpetrator.
Right. And so people get into this headspace of, I have to double down as much as possible to defend myself, lest I accidentally incriminate myself.
Right, right.
And the opposite is actually true. Most of the time, especially when it's between partners, people who have been together for quite a long time, an honest apology, an honest listening to the other person, making sure the other person feels heard, is what reduces the impact. It changes the whole situation.
Right, right. Hi, it's Jessa here, taking just a quick break. Thanks for listening so far. I wanted to let you know about the sex quiz that I've put together called How Healthy Is Your Sex Life? I've taken a close look at the typical ways that I see couples get into trouble with sex, including avoidance, neglect, negativity, distraction, and boredom. And the free quiz will score your individual results based on these factors. And then I provide my recommendations and ideas, including my top 10 sex tips, which will help you make instant improvement. If you'd like to take the quiz and see how healthy your sex life is, you can do it right now at sexhealthquiz.com. What about examples? I mean, if any come to mind, where the intention isn't so pure, it's not just an accident. I mean, we're not talking about rape, not all the way at the far end of the spectrum, but what kinds of things do you think, or have you heard about, that have come up between couples where it's not quite so pure?
I think that's where we step into issues of entitlement most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
People get into that place of, we're married, you owe me this thing, whether that's sex or money or children or whatever. So those are situations that are less pure, but not all the way too malicious.
Okay.
You know, where people feel like they deserve a thing, regardless of how the other person feels about it. They haven't quite stepped all the way into, I'm doing this to hurt you.
Right, right.
But they have stepped into the, I care less about you than I care about myself.
Right. That's a nice way of putting that continuum.
Yeah.
Certainly that comes up in the clients I see a fair amount. unfortunately. I mean, accidents come up too, mm-hmm. but that sense of entitlement, or I'm thinking more about me than I'm thinking about you. And it's sometimes hard for both people to recognize that.
Oh, sure. And it's hard to come back from it too, but being able to talk about it, and this is where we get into, you know, more complex issues, right? Where a person who has a specific need, be it emotionally or sexually, right? They have that need as part of who they are. And as part of who they are, that need deserves to be realized.
Mm-hmm.
But it may not be able to be realized by the partner they're with.
Maybe an example would be helpful.
Sure. I take a pretty simple one that I've seen in my office. I had a couple I saw, and one of them liked to be tied up. Pretty simple bondage, a little bit of light BDSM. So that's part of their sexuality. They had done it before they got into that relationship, and their other partner couldn't bring themselves to do it. It felt mm-hmm. it felt wrong to them. It felt like they were hurting the other person. It was just not sexy at all. And at the beginning, the person who liked being tied up was like, okay, I'll give this up for you. I love you. I care about you. I won't do it. But over time, the need just built and built and built until it became a constant source of argument. I do this thing for you. Why won't you do this thing for me? Again, we get back into that issue of resentment.
Right, right.
They finally came in to be like, how do we resolve this? And in the end, it was they moved into a consensual non-monogamous space where she could go and play, not have sex, but could go and be tied up by other people so that she could get that need fulfilled, and then she would come home and have sex with her partner.
Right. And certainly that's a big area of consent, right? Whether people are going to open their relationship or not.
Sure.
And that's one way to handle that kind of, I guess I'd call a mismatch of eroticism.
But sure.
Certainly plenty of people are not willing to change the rules on their monogamous relationship. So
right.
I guess at that point it gets a lot hairier.
Yeah. At that point, either the person who doesn't want to do the thing becomes willing to do it, like gets over their concern, fear, issue, block, whatever, in order to give the other person what they need. The person who has the need gives that up,
right,
or finds some other way to fulfill it through fantasy, through imagination.
Right, right. Masturbation, whatever it might be.
Masturbation, some other thing. Or they split up. Because
or they split up, right.
Can't be resolved.
Right, right. Some sort of compromise or not.
Yeah.
So you started to talk a little bit earlier, like one of the things I definitely want to get to, you know, on this episode is the idea of what do people do when a consent incident has happened? Like how, you know, are there certain steps or stages of that kind of repair? And I'm sure it varies to some degree based on the severity of the incident.
Sure.
But what's a basic approach? What could people take away on that?
Basic approach is stay calm.
Right? Good reminder. Yeah.
Remember to breathe. Remember to basically manage your own emotion first before taking your emotion to the other person. It's a thing that has to be talked about. It's a thing that has to be resolved. But doing that in a highly emotional state is usually going to cause problems rather than solutions. So that's step one, breathe. Step two is communicate. If you feel like you can talk to the person who did it, talk to them about it. If you're in a situation, you know, like in a long-term relationship, you're really going to need to talk about it at some point. The longer you wait, the worse it's going to get.
Right, right. This isn't just someone you're dating that you might just decide, you know, not to continue to see.
Right.
You're going to have to address it.
So in that case, if you need help, get help. Right. See a therapist.
Right.
See a couples therapist. See your own therapist if you just need to talk it out and process it. Process it with a friend or a confidant, someone you can open up to who will listen and let you get your feelings out so that you can get to what it is that you really want to say. Because usually at the base of these things are, I need you to know that I was hurt. I need you to do something different. And I need you to tell me how you're going to do that thing differently.
Okay.
For the person whose consent was violated. For the person who was the violator or who made a mistake or whatever the circumstance is in that incident, for them it's, okay, how do I manage my own feelings? How do I give an honest apology? And how do I make sure I don't do it again? And preferably show the other person how I'm not going to do it again.
Right.
So it's a very much a parallel process.
Okay.
Each person figures out what they need in the situation and then comes together to talk about that thing either, you know, with support or after having processed it out so they know what it is they actually want.
Is there an extra step when it's not an accident? You know, like back to the theme of entitlement we were talking about. Somebody has a belief that they're entitled now that they're married or whatever it is, and the other person is not wanting to do that anymore. I mean, certainly that seems like a prime situation to go to therapy.
Yeah.
But anything else to consider when that's part of the equation?
Well, actually, going to therapy or talking to a priest or a minister if you're in part of a congregation.
Right.
At that point, you really need a third person outside perspective. You need somebody who can listen to both sides, validate both opinions, and sort of help navigate through, look, I understand this is something you need. I understand this is something you really want. And your partner is still an autonomous human being and doesn't have to give it to you.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then we're stepping into issues of family of origin. We're stepping into issues of culture of origin. We're stepping into like base assumptions of how the world works.
Right, right.
And once you have one of those, it's really hard to work it out with the person who is triggering the very assumption that's causing the problem.
Right, right. Makes sense. So I'm curious, are there, you know, it's kind of getting time to wrap up. Are there books about consent that you recommend? And then you have mentioned the Consent Academy several times in the call. So I would love for you to have the chance to talk more about what you're doing there.
Sure. So I don't actually have books to recommend. I know there are several being written right now.
Okay.
But none that are currently really published on the topic.
Okay.
If you Google for consent, a bunch of things will pop up. There's some interesting links and videos and other things to look at there. The Consent Academy is a Seattle-based organization of consent educators and activists who I founded a little bit more than a year ago now. And our job is to educate people. So we go into schools, we go into organizations, we work with clubs and pretty much all sorts of different things to teach either the people who are organizing events or to teach their membership about the basics of consent and how to act in a more consensual way as a way of trying to create a larger consent culture and to build that as a way to move beyond these issues of entitlement, as a way to move beyond these issues of expectation to a place where people can make honest requests and give honest answers.
Wow, what an amazing endeavor. I hope you take that nationally.
Yeah, we do. We've been to New York. We've been to California, Oregon. So little by little.
Yeah, yeah. But it's such a needed service and great information. And,
yeah,
you know, maybe with all the stuff in the news, you end up with some wind in the sails to promote that too.
Oh, I certainly hope so. We have coming up in January, we have a Consent Fest, which is our yearly party to celebrate consent. So that'll be coming up. www.consent.academy is our website.
Okay.
And people are more than welcome to look us up and just send us questions if you have them. We're happy to get to that answer.
Great. And any, how can people learn just more about you specifically, your practice, or keep in touch with you?
Sure. You can go to my therapy website is www.significantconnections.com. I work primarily with identity therapy and couples therapy, including non-monogamy and alternative sexualities.
Great. Well, I'll have you back on here to talk about those topics another time.
Oh, I would be happy to. I love doing it.
Great. Well, thank you so much, sir.
My pleasure. It was great to talk with you today.
Great.
You've been listening to Better Sex. Please visit our website, bettersexpodcast.com, for show notes and additional episodes.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you found that this episode resonated with you, I would love to hear from you. You can leave me a comment on the episode page. You'll find a link in the episode description. And if you've got time, again, please visit iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, and consider rating and reviewing the show. That's what helps other people find us. Thanks so much. See you next time.
Our theme music has been composed, recorded, and provided by Rick Ruskin, courtesy of Lion Dog Music.